Hi, welcome to episode 30-something of the UCB New York podcast. Yeah. Holy shit, we're doing a podcast again.
Yeah, that's right.
Will.
So we have to talk about how that happened.
All right.
Which is we got strong-armed into it.
Yeah, sitting next to me is Will Hines.
Yeah, sitting next to me is John Frusciante.
And with us today is Mike Still.
Hi, everyone.
Hello, Mike.
So Mike Still, I mean, we haven't done a podcast in, what, 7 years?
We haven't, yeah, not since before 9/11. We haven't done one in a really long time. The last time we did a podcast was about how much we love the X-Files.
Yeah, yeah, and we were really excited for the Lone Gunman.
Oh, yeah. That was a sure hit, we said. That was the end of our last podcast, was predicting the Lone Gunman would change television.
You know who was a writer on Lone Gunman?
I don't know.
Vince Gilligan, creator of Breaking Bad.
Oh, yeah, there we go. We were just talking about Breaking Bad.
We were just talking about Breaking Bad before we hit record.
Yeah.
Yeah.
His first TV writing job was the X-Files.
Oh,
that's
wow.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's a good, that's really cool.
Yeah.
We get some supernatural stuff in Breaking Bad. That'd be great.
There you go. And he cast, what's his name? Walter White. What's his fucking?
Bryan Cranston. Bryan,
yeah. Bryan Cranston.
Was he in the X-Files?
He cast him in a small role in the X-Files. Mm. That's how he sold him to AMC.
Right.
Huh.
Anyway, we're doing a podcast again because Mike Still's
promoting a show. Let's just get that. Let's put our cards on the table. You're promoting a show.
Yeah,
Mike Still, Dictator for Life.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
God knows if we'll get this podcast up in time for this to be effective promotion.
Well, it's tomorrow.
You will probably be a movie
star. The show's tomorrow. We might
But there's
do
one later in the month also, and hopefully it'll be in whatever month.
Right.
I'm not referring to these months specifically because I just, like, for example, listened to the Delaney podcast like
which
2 days
like last
ago.
Which November, right?
I don't know. It could have been, yeah.
Yeah, these exist in a sort of nebulous void,
right.
These podcasts.
Exactly.
Today is July something.
Uh-huh. July 7th.
Right.
Yeah.
July
so your 7th. Show's July 8th.
And the 22nd.
Okay.
And you know,
you'll be
future.
A movie star before this podcast airs.
You could hope so.
Yeah, that'd be great.
But Mike Still emailed Will and I.
And just said, am I remembering this right? Didn't he just say, like, so guys, we doing the podcast this Thursday?
No, your first email was, I'd love to do the podcast and promote my show. Now, we get...
That happens like
that
once
happens
a week.
That happens regularly. People email us and say, I have a show. And Will and I kind of file them into like, we'll do it eventually.
Do you ever get any students that ask to do the podcast?
I don't think we've ever gotten a request that seemed crazy.
No. But
it's more just like John and I have just been completely disorganized.
Right.
Like we sit next to each other in the office and we have said to each other, I think every week since the last one we did, we're going to do a podcast this week.
Right.
Yeah, we'll do one.
And then Will plays for me an Elvis Costello song.
And then we talk about that for half an hour. And then we go back. We go, I got to get some work done. And we go get some work done. And we go home and the podcast doesn't happen. It's ridiculous.
But what Mike did, which no one has ever done before, is continuously emailed us to the point where he was basically saying, I'm coming in on Thursday.
But I remember an email like that. Like we kept saying, we're into it. We'll figure it out and get or something. You know, like, we'll do it sometime.
Right.
But then at some point you sent an email, Mike, that I think just said, so guys, this Thursday?
I
you pretended as
back,
if we had agreed to do it.
I sent it at like 3:07. A.M. on a Tuesday or something like that. So who knows what I was into.
Yeah.
And
but I remember that wording was so funny. It's kind of just like walking into an office being like, is this my desk?
I'm going to sit right here.
And just kind of like, I guess it is.
Yeah.
And like nobody contests you.
Okay.
It's like an impressive, passive-aggressive sales technique.
Yeah.
That worked like a charm.
It really did.
I get into most of my relationships that way. I'm like, so? What are
so
we
we're
going
dating
on vacation?
At this point?
Yeah.
So, right.
We need to get away. I don't know we were dating. Right.
Yeah. And
he also said in his email that he would bring sandwiches.
Yes.
Which we just disregarded as a bit instantly.
As a matter of fact, the email was, what kind of sandwiches do you like? Which I didn't even respond to because I was like, I don't have time for this bit.
Right. We had to play American Girl by Tom Petty for 20 times in a row and analyze why that song is so good.
Right, which is a conversation we actually had.
Yeah,
A couple of minutes
ago. That song mystifies me. It bewitches me. Mike,
bewitches you.
I like it, but I wonder how it works. But we'll talk about that.
Right.
Never.
As I explained to you, it's the bridge.
I'm not so sure.
But now we're sitting here.
I don't know anything about Tom Petty.
We're sitting here.
You know the song American Girl.
American Girl.
She
was close.
Yeah,
close.
What song? She was an American girl.
Yeah,
okay.
That's right.
In theory.
She
that is
was
it.
An American girl.
Okay. Yes. That is it. You're right. That is it. But we are now sitting here in the podcast tent.
Wait, finish the sandwich story.
With sandwiches.
Yeah, we got a nice asparagus
Mike brought
one.
Sandwiches.
They're from Number 7 Sub in the Ace Hotel.
Ooh, good place.
I frequent that place.
Yeah.
And then we have a short rib and I don't know.
Generous.
Yeah.
I had one. So I had half of the asparagus sandwich, and it was great.
It's good.
Okay. So if you hear me noshing in the middle of this podcast,
I might dive into that
because of the sandwiches. Okay, Mike Still, you have the show Dictator for Life. You're on Death by Ruru. You're a hilarious dude. You've got a great beard.
Thank you.
How did you get here? How did you get to UCB?
To UCB? I went to Penn State University, right? And I would do writing there, but we didn't do a lot of sketch comedy there. We'd write plays. We'd write like sketch or like kind of funny plays. Me and my buddy Nate Kushner would write plays together. We wrote a play called Jesus, the Missing Years.
Can you do an impersonation of Nate Kushner? He's got a very distinctive voice. Nate Kushner.
Oh,
yeah,
Jesus. I was thinking.
Yeah, I got this guitar thing I'm doing.
Yeah. So, I'm going to check that out. Okay, that's cool. Nate's a wonderful man, beautiful man. He's in a great band called Igloos. I'll plug that. Everyone should go and see that. But we'd write plays together. We wrote Jesus, the Missing Years. We weren't particularly.
Oh, that thing fell over.
Oh, no, right.
Sorry, everybody.
But we weren't like religious or anything, but we thought it'd be fun to do a show called about Jesus.
Okay.
And that was somewhat of a success. And then after that, I moved to New York in 2004, and Nate was like, you got to do sketch comedy. I'm like, no, man, I want to do like Shakespeare. I want to like be in plays and stuff.
Right.
Uh-huh. But I found that like the off-Broadway circuit, you just basically do weird people's vanity shows.
Right. Mm. I think I've seen some of those.
Yeah.
I went through a phase of like going to Time Out New York like for 6 months, and every week I would see something based on my budget, which was generally low.
Yeah.
So I'd go to the off-Broadway section. And you would see sometimes a very cool thing.
Yeah.
Or a weird thing that was entertaining. But also a lot of times you saw kind of a half-formed idea.
Right.
Yep. You know, or something like, that was more noise than signal.
Yeah. I was in a show, which I really enjoyed being in at the time. But it was a production of Finnegan's Wake.
Whoa.
It was a production of Finnegan's Wake that was 3 hours long. And it was just like insane. It didn't make any sense. I played a character called the Mooksa at one point. And I had an argument with this other. It was the Mooksa versus something. It's a part of Finnegan's Wake. This bishop type character.
Yeah.
It was like an 8-9 minute scene where it was like us being real combative and arguing. None of it made sense. It was just all Joycean, just insane stuff. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed doing it at the time. I was, you know, like 25 years old.
Sure.
I was like, yeah, I'm doing this. I'm in New York doing shows.
Yeah. Cool.
And then you realize you've just spent 6 months of your life. Something that does not make
reciting nonsense.
Yeah.
Reciting nonsense.
When you could have been here doing sound and movement openings.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So in 2006, I got involved with classes. I took my 101 with Amy Rhodes. Yeah, back in the day.
Yeah.
And then
I had just started teaching. This is 2005? I'm trying to orient myself.
2006, January 2006.
I was a super vet already.
No, you were a super vet at that point?
I'd just come back.
You returned?
Yeah.
Shantae returned?
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, so I did that, and then I had like Anthony King and 201, and this was we would rehearse in the theater, or we had class in the theater, like actually on the stage, which was pretty cool.
Yeah,
And I just started getting into it, and jumping back, so me and Nate and our friend Dan Hopper formed a sketch group called A Week of Kindness.
Oh yeah,
in 2005 ish, and we performed a lot in the city. We performed all over the place. And that stayed pretty strong for like 3 years.
I like that your sketch group. I remember when you guys emerged, and I liked that you had a sketch group that was named something nice.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of sketch groups are trying so hard to be either funny with a pun.
Oh God.
Or so up to, you know, and I've done it. So this is, I don't mean this to be as judgmental as the tone I am going to adopt.
Uh-huh.
But either like obtuse, to where you're not really saying anything, or worse is like some kind of mean, aggressive name.
Yeah.
I sometimes like it, but I feel like it's a go-to in a way. So A Week of Kindness I thought was kind of a cool...
It's surprising and refreshing.
There was Nate's idea. It was a book of graphic poetry. Not graphic, but it was like from Sears Roebuck catalogs. This guy named Max Ernst would cut out pictures from Sears Roebuck catalogs and make like these collages that told stories.
Mm-hmm.
And one of his works was called A Week of Kindness. So that's where that's from. Very literary.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. Wow, that's pretty smart considering I think the first sketch I saw was a Dungeons and Dragons. What did I see? You guys performed at New York Comic Con.
Yes, we performed at New York Comic Con. I remember that because Will did stand-up. It was the first time he did stand-up, right?
It was pretty early, yeah. Matt Little just said, do you want to do stand-up at New York Comic Con?
Yeah.
I goes, yes, I do.
Matt Little organized it, and we all went and did it. And the first year that we did it, they set up a stage, and they were really cool, but they set up the stage thinking that the line for Comic Con was going to be larger than it was.
Yeah,
so the stage was in the corner of the Javits Center, and the line kind of like snaked out a little bit towards the stage and then came back about... Probably 50 to 70 feet before the stage.
Big empty room.
Huge empty room.
At the far end of the room was like a little U of a line.
Yeah.
People kind of half distracted.
Like looking over at like people in, you know, wizard outfits.
Right.
So.
Wow.
So Week of Kindness, we did the whole Sketchfest circuit and all that sort of stuff. And I really enjoyed doing the sketch, but a lot of people were taking improv, and I'm like,
who are the other members of Week of Kindness before we move on?
So it was Nate Kushner,
sure,
and Dan Hopper were the primary members. They
is
were
he still
the
blogging
for
Best Week Ever.
He blogs for bestweekever.tv.
He's hilarious.
He's very, very funny man. And then there were several other members that were in like the first like 6 months.
Oh, okay.
Of it. Yeah, someone named Erica Harsh, someone named Alicia Pawanda, Devin T. Quinn was in two shows, but you know they left.
Right. Right. Okay. Now I'm ready for you to move on.
Okay. Sure. So then I started taking improv and just hated it. Like, I was like so bad at it. Cause it was like the first time I started doing it, I was just like, oh my God, this is really hard.
You hated it, really?
Well, for the first few classes, I was like, what is this stuff?
Uh-huh. What do you think made you have that reaction?
I think I was thinking too hard about it. I think I was thinking so hard about the improv.
Did you come in like trying, like, did you have like an actor's kind of mentality towards it, or were you trying to reconcile improv theory with some other kind of technique or theory?
I think I was like in that classic, like, oh man, I'm trying to think too much about that. Like, I'm coming up with the ideas, writing scenes, like, just being like, where's the scene gonna go?
Right.
All that worry about, like, where will things end up?
Yeah.
Just, like, not being in the present
moment. Yeah, because I encounter students in 101 sometimes who are actors, and, like, they'll ask me, like, well, you know, what is the plot of the scene? You know?
Yeah.
And, like, what do we want, and like what's the goal and all that stuff, you know? And they're perfectly valid questions, and some of them sort of have answers that translate to improv.
Yeah.
But like, I do find people kind of have to reverse out of that actor's mentality. And
then
go
you
down
start realizing like we're only trying to do, you know, what's funny. You're trying to take the thing that's funny and do it again.
Yeah.
You know, and then once you realize that, and you're like, if you have a sense of humor, which most people have some sort of sense of humor, you can start isolating what's funny and doing it again, you know?
Yeah.
But I was just thinking way too hard about it. So I think that led to a lot of, like, indie... Well, this was, like, before I was even on, like, an indie team. It was just general confusion about, like, how to even do improv.
Right.
But that was the challenging part for me, because it was like, oh, I'm hitting something that I'm not getting, like, right away, that it's not just like, oh, that's easy.
Right.
So that's
what
kept me coming back, because I'm like, I will solve this. Like, performing improv and feeling as though you're operating at, like, 17% of your potential is just such like a challenging thing for me. I'm like, no man, I'm gonna get this. I'm gonna get this shit.
Yeah.
Oh,
pretty cool. I didn't know that.
So you are taking classes and then you start doing the indie scene.
Yeah, what's your bunch of indie teams?
I was on an indie team, so I got through my 501 and it came around to audition time. And this was when Bastion was made. So this was like 2007, early 2007.
Okay.
And I auditioned and had an audition that was like, what are you doing? I got a call back, which was great.
Uh-huh.
We did a Herald in there. And I remember like one of my moves was to go and be someone's like bedpost, like go be a bedpost. And I'm like, why? I'm making the move. I was just like, why did I go be a bedpost? There's no reason to do that.
Yeah.
I didn't get on a team, but I didn't know anything about like the indie world. I knew nothing about that. Anthony sent out an email to some people and were just like, yeah, you know, keep trying. You're going to do great. I'm like, what do I do? And he's like, do you perform outside of class? I'm like, no. He's like, oh, go do that. So Ryan Willard formed, he was in a class with me. He formed Know You Kitten, which was an indie team that I was on with
I remember that.
Molly Lloyd and Andre Vermeulen and Anna Rubinova was on that.
Nice.
Yeah.
Good group.
Good group.
Lots of apostrophes in that name, as I recall.
Yeah, right? Apostrophes and some...
I coached you guys once.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I sub-coached you once.
Nice.
I saw you listed on a website.
No, You Kitten?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. You saw that.
I think, did you come back and either do Cage Match or some kind of, like, Cage Match, indie Cage Match tournament or thing?
I don't know if we ever did, like, one of those...
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those indie Cage Match things.
So you start doing Know You Kitten, and you're doing shows around the city, yeah. right? And you feel like at this point, like you're starting to get it, like something is starting to click.
Yeah, yeah.
You got cocky.
Got a little cocky. That's what it is. Yeah. You have to get a little bit of cocky on stage. You have to be like, I think this is funny, so I'm going to go with it. You know what I mean? I'm going to like jump on this thing that I think is funny, you know, that's not to the... exception of yes-anding people in support, but it's just being like, hey, this is my fun idea. You start just getting out there. I think what happened was doing Know You Kitten, and it's like we'd do shows at bars, we'd do shows at like Mo Pitkins and stuff, and have a few beers before it, you know? That helped me out.
Right.
Yeah. I hate to say that, but it did. It loosened me up.
Okay. Right, right.
So everybody get drunk
before you show. Perform. That's it. That's all you have to do.
You definitely have a unique confidence and boldness on stage when you perform, both as an improviser. Like, I remember I used to watch you all the time on Harold Knight, and you have a commanding kind of presence and aggression to you.
Yeah, I think it's also, you can just tell that you've had acting experience.
That's right.
Like you get to, oh, this guy did plays and worried about his energy and intention beyond just what he got in his 201 class, which is what I did.
Yeah, that's where I was going. Like you can bring that kind of acting thing to it. Is that, did you find at some point you were consciously like, okay, now I'm able to kind of meld these two worlds together, or do you think it just kind of happened?
When did it happen? One of the big moments where it was just like, oh, I can be like confident on stage was I took Billy Merritt's Ninja 600 class, right?
So that was his last one, I think.
It was his last.
Was that
before
like the
he
spotlight
moved to LA.
Was in the middle of the stage?
Yes.
And people would like jump in from the darkness?
Yeah. We all wore ninja outfits. We all wore full ninja outfits. And we were doing this exercise. It was Billy Merritt and Anthony Atamanik, right?
So great. We gotta do it again.
Yeah, we should.
Do that again.
Oh, it was amazing. It was a great form. It was a really cool form.
Ryan Carles wants to, in all seriousness, do a samurai class.
Oh, really?
He's come up to me many times, sometimes inebriated, and just been like, I need, I'm really interested in the samurai. I'd like to do a samurai 600. I'm like, well, I love the sounds of it. What does that mean? And he has no idea how to manifest
he's
it.
Like
he's really into the philosophy.
Something
he
about
gave me
Bushido.
A couple of books, and I read these two books on samurai philosophy, and I'm like, I dig it too, and I do see it overlapping with improv, but I don't know how you do a samurai show.
Wow, there's so much respect, and if you do a bad scene, you have to kill yourself.
yeah.
You have to stab yourself.
Yeah.
You have the headman there to chop your head off so you don't suffer as your guts fall out of your stomach.
Yeah, if you do a scene that doesn't have game or doesn't get laughs, you have to leave the show.
Yeah, and they kill your family and your wife.
If anybody's
and kid.
Listening to this and has an idea for a samurai show, I want to hear it. We thought about having the samurai, you pick people from the audience, and you are a master to them and you do improv with them and your whole goal is to protect them and to make their scenes successful.
Okay.
And something like that. And if you fail, you have to kill yourself.
You have to kill yourself.
There'd be like some kind of judge or something.
Oh, Lord.
And there's a tea ceremony. Instead of a group game, it's a tea ceremony. Just
maybe
this very measured
do it,
tea ceremony.
Maybe you have a tea ceremony. There's some kind of declaration of truth or something. Or some kind of deconstruction-y middle. I don't know.
Well, we had to do crazy eights in Japanese in the ninja class.
What?
Yeah. Yeah.
So tell me more about this class.
So the class was the ninja. Billy Merritt's the ninja. Mm-hmm. And it was based off of an exercise that I know Billy would do in 501 where it was you have to play game like a robot, attack the scene like a pirate.
And edit like a ninja.
And edit like a ninja, right? Mm-hmm. So, and he took the ninja part of that and was like, let's make a whole class around it. So the first few classes were pretty, we would... So Anthony Antaminick, who was also the co-teacher
the best,
of
the best co-teacher.
It was best. It was best. So he turned off all the lights and we would lay on the ground and take us on a vision journey to find what we would find. And you're walking over a hill and you see something. What is that you see up there? And eventually you found out what your spirit animal was.
I love it. Now let me just ask
what was yours?
I was a gorilla. So that's getting back to the point about one of the moments of melding performance and the funniness was we had to act perform as our spirit animal, right? So performing as a gorilla was just a moment where I'm like, oh, I can just not, it was one of the times where I was thinking less. I was just being a gorilla on stage.
Billy's
it was
classes such a big were moment always for good me. For that. Yeah, I always took a Billy class and just felt great.
Yeah.
You felt like confident, and at least that was my experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Doing stuff with Billy.
So the form itself was we started out with like 8 or 10 mini scenes that like okay. that was like the opening. You would have a couple quick sure. scenes, you know, some like kind of like the Stepfather 3 scenes sure, in the yeah. beginning sort of thing, right? Mm-hmm. Except then the person would get killed immediately. All the edits were done where a ninja would picture this. There's a light in the middle of the stage.
Spotlight
in the middle of the stage. All 16 ninjas, because they didn't split it in halves, would be creeping around the theater, right? Just like all outside. And at any time the scene was about to be done, it was time for the edit, a ninja would jump in and kill the people in the scene. And you would try to like have some sort of novel way of killing them.
Yeah.
Right. You know, you'd like, yeah. you'd grab, you know, put a noose around their neck and throw something over the raptors and like crack their necks or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And then the next, and then they would die. Other ninjas would have to come and drag their bodies off. And the next scene would start.
Awesome.
So, yeah.
Amazing.
I never, the only thing I knew about that, once I was walking through the back of the theater while that show was going on. Some sort of tech was happening after that I was doing.
Okay.
So I wasn't there to see the show, but I'm just in the middle of the ninja show. There's a spotlight. There's all these people in ninja. I'm like, what is this? It's Billy Klass. I'm like, all right.
It was amazing. And I still have that ninja outfit. To this day. Oh. I think Rory Panagiotopoulos actually has it. I loaned it to him for a Gramps sketch. So, yeah, it's still around. It's still around.
So what happened to you after that?
So there it's like, okay, cool. Like,
actually, I have one more question.
Go ahead.
As a guy who runs the school, I have this question. In the middle of the ninja class, and I love the ninja class, and I love everything you just described about it. This is not a criticism. But do you feel like in the middle of that, when you're lying on the floor and the teacher turns the lights out and takes you on a vision quest, you're like, I paid $300, you know, $300+,
right.
whatever it was at that time, for this?
Well, I tell you what, like, if every single day was half of it was a vision quest, then maybe I would feel like that. But it was one towards the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it made sense to kind of bond the class. And,
yeah.
Yeah, I can see that.
And it made, and what was really cool was, like, for all the kind of like mumbo jumbo of like vision questy and like a spirit animal and all that, it's like you really did connect. Like people connected with their, you know, spirit animal, because mm-hmm. it was a way to be like, this is like my idealized way of performing. I'm a fucking gorilla on stage. This is my idealized version of uh-huh. what I should be. So having that was like a great touchstone for
sure.
being able to perform. It's like I use that a lot, and then, you know, on Herald Night, and just being like, I'm a gorilla, and just like remind yourself that.
Mm.
Yeah.
So that was helpful.
I wonder if that too is part of that merging of like the improv technique and kind of the arty kind of acting kind of theory and everything, that
yeah.
willingness to like understand this is helpful to me
yeah.
in absolutely. Some way.
Because I feel like the people who write that shit off are just like, well, when am I going to be famous already?
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, how is this going to make me famous and funny? You
right.
know, like,
yeah.
You, the people who can kind of dig in and realize this is a step towards a larger goal
absolutely.
Are the people who are going to reap the benefits of those exercises.
And it comes down to like involving your whole self in performing, involving like your whole, your body, your mind, like having all that, bringing that with you on stage, which is yeah. a lot of like, you know, the more actory techniques of just being on stage, you know, mm-hmm. existing on stage.
Yeah.
That is the challenge sometimes, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people, I think, get stuck because they don't know that that's a thing. That
sure.
It's like a...
Now, you mentioned that you sometimes think of the gorilla thing. Mm-hmm. What other ways do you get past that kind of getting stuck that you just mentioned? Like, what other actory kind of things do you remind yourself of?
I think a big one is just emotion. Just like, you know, thinking about, you know, how do you feel about whatever decisions are being made on stage? Like, mm-hmm. as soon as you have that, how do you feel? How does your character feel? Then it's like, okay, cool. I know how to go forward, because emotions are just so much more visceral in terms of like, versus like trying to think of like, well, this is what I think of this. It's like, but really, how do you feel about it? Because often I think a lot when you see scenes that get like stuck, it's because people aren't saying how they feel about something on stage, mm-hmm. you know? So I feel like just tapping into like, how does your character feel about this? Uh-huh. You know, that's a big way to like kind of push past that.
Sure.
I love hearing about people's breakthroughs. Okay, we're going again. Battery died, and now we're back. I was saying I like to hear people's breakthroughs. I think it's always interesting.
We just ate a whole sandwich.
Yeah.
More sandwiches got eaten. Well, so the battery died, and I got a new battery. You guys ate a sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
And what were we talking about when I got back?
Breakthroughs.
The idea.
Breakthroughs.
But also being scared of, not being scared of, but being wary about being an eternal student or something. What were you just saying?
Oh, we weren't saying that on the air. We were just saying that now.
I know, but I want to hear about it anyway.
Oh, okay.
Well, something that I, there's always the fear of, like, you never want to just be seen as only a student. And this is advice that I give to some of my classes, too, where I tell them to do your own stuff. Have your own sketch group. Have your own improv group. Don't only depend on UCB for your performance opportunities, because you're going to come up wanting, you know.
Yeah.
Even if you get every performance opportunity that UCB has to offer, you're going to still be like, "Well, where's my movie deal and stuff?" And you're like, "Well, that guy's a movie deal, and he didn't even get on a mod team." And you're like, "Yeah, well, he's been writing screenplays on his own in his house."
Yeah.
You
know?
Yeah. There's the idea. I think we've talked about this on the podcast before, but like winning UCB, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, that should not be your goal.
It should not be
anybody's goal.
And the other thing is, if you make that your goal of just only getting opportunities from UCB, you end up not bringing everything you can to UCB. Because UCB, it really, other than the, I'd say, Harold Knight, maybe sort of Cage Match, and like the weekend teams, like it's, and I guess Maud Knight, right? That's what, like 40% of the schedule or 45% of the schedule?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
55, I don't know. It still needs your material. It still needs your unique voice, which you need to go and work on. You can't just like be waiting around and being like, "Winter Herald auditions." Ugh.
Yeah.
Well, what else are you doing?
Nothing. Although it's easy to say that, people who are in the system and have been for years. Like you got to call back your first audition, then you run a team the next year, $12,000, you know, and then...
Bad man.
Yeah. Right.
Did you do... Were you...
I was on $12,000 first.
Right.
I got in that in August of 2007.
Right.
And then...
So 6 months after your callback.
6 months after my callback. I was pretty lucky. I got...
There is
got
a team in...
Bad Bangs.
Bangs, that's it.
Yeah, Bangs. So it was $12,000. That got busted up. And then Bangs was around. And that also got busted up. And then Bad Man was around, which was around until like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And now on Death by Ruru. So, like, you are kind of winning UCB.
Sure.
Like, you are. Like, you got to call back your first audition and then put on a team later that year, and now you're on a weekend team.
But the reason I was able to is I feel because I had things to bring to the table. When I got to UCB, it was right at A Week of Kindnesses, like, was in full swing. Mm-hmm. At the time, we were... You know, getting on the front of like MySpace, which was at the time
meant
something.
Oh my god, I remember that.
Yeah, like it was amazing. We'd get like huge numbers of hits on our videos and stuff. Uh-huh. Like it was like, it was like a commodity almost. Like this guy is doing stuff. And beyond that, like had the acting side to which kind of like bolsters out the improv side, lets you kind of stand out from the crowd a little bit.
Right.
And
I agree with you. I shouldn't sound like I'm disagreeing with you, but I do.
You're playing devil's advocate. It's fine.
Thank you. Thank you, John.
You're welcome.
I think you're disagreeing.
But I, you know...
I feel bad, though, for people who, like, they want to be a comedian, but maybe their voice isn't, like, defined yet. Like, I remember when I was starting out, like, I wanted to do all that, and I would kind of... I would go do open mics in, like, the late 90s, and I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't have jokes. I barely had an opinion about anything.
Well, I think the best thing to do is team up with someone that you think is really funny. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Like, sure.
And then you kind of all grapple. That was the beautiful thing about being on a sketch group soon after I moved to New York, was that we're all kind of grappling in the dark together. You know? And at the very least, you have like a small group of people that you're trying to make laugh. The three of you, you're like, or however many people are on the sketch group.
Yeah, collaboration is a really important aspect to comedic development.
Oh, yeah, I think. Hugely.
An important, and I think underused, I think. Mm-hmm. Not undervalued, but underused.
Might be undervalued, because when I read that book, And Here's the Kicker, the Mike Sachs book where he interviews all these comedy writers, did you read that, Mike Stone?
Mm-hmm. I've read portions of it.
Well, you should read the whole thing.
The whole thing.
And it's a really great read, and it's he interviews everybody from someone who wrote jokes for Milton Berle, is one of the people he interviews, to like Robert Smigel, you know, who did all the great sketches for SNL and Conan, and Meryl Marcoux, who was the original head writer of Letterman.
Right.
Really, they're really interesting interviews. Mm-hmm. Most of them talk about their collaborators.
Oh my god, yeah.
I think one of the people even says, like, "Oh, I've always written comedy with somebody else."
Yeah.
Like, it's really hard to do it on your own. I think the Milton Berle guy was...
One of my favorite places to be is... I've been directing Gramps for probably about a year now, and in that writer's room, I love being in a writer's room. It's so fun. It's just fun.
Yep.
You're all collaborating, like... You get the bullshit about stuff, and then it's like it counts as work, because then we take that and we
Exactly. Yeah, I had the same experience directing Thunder Gulch for a year. It's like you get the joy of like watching other people help other people's work, and also yourself helping other people's work, and also like somebody makes some hilarious offhanded comment or bit, and then all of a sudden everybody's kind of going and spinning that into something that becomes a great sketch.
Yeah,
like, I disagree. I like to lock myself in a room, turn off the phones, and just I don't need anything to pollute my genius.
Your genius,
I have a
voice,
and if anything gets in the way of it, I'm going to burn it with my nuclear intensity.
Yeah.
Get the fuck out of my way, is what I say.
Charles Bukowski.
When I directed Stone Cold Fox for a month, and I told them all to shut the fuck up when I was in the writer's room. I was like, I will tell you what your sketch is, I said. Mike Trapp, I said, you shut the fuck up. And he said, no, I wrote the sketch, and I slapped him. I said, you shut up. You shut up. I tell you what to do.
You were in prison for a while.
I went to prison. Which is, the charges were valid, and I pled guilty.
You wrote a lot of good stuff in there, though.
In there, but then finally I was alone. I got to do my great work.
You were in prison, and then you acted out until you were put in the hole.
That's
right. So that you could write comedy.
I finally got my goal to be in solitary. And I wrote my one-man show, Wheelbarrow Full of Canucks.
We just made fun of Canadians.
Made fun of Canadians.
Oh, what was
really,
the...
Like, really low-hanging fruit, too. It was just all like, well, whoa, I'm Canadian.
You know what? That's where my... Shut the fuck up. My artistic voice pointed me in
there.
There
was one really great character from... Wheelbarrow Full of Canucks. You
it was the Manitobian minister.
Yeah, yeah. What was his catchphrase?
His catchphrase was, look at the mountains. He was a distracting game. He would get into trouble and just be like, look at those mountains. And he would get out of trouble.
Who broke this glass?
That's right. Oh, that guy was great too. So, you know, I think collaboration is a dead end.
So, speaking of Wheelbarrow Full of Canucks, you have this solo show.
Yes. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Mike's Still Dictator for Life.
Yeah, that's Mike's Still Dictator for Life.
So, tell us about the origin.
Tell us about the shamelessness of putting your name in the title.
Yeah.
Oh, well,
Let's talk about that first.
You got to get your name in the title. That's important. Uh-huh. You want to get your name out there because then it's printed a lot more, you know? Because at the end of the day, like, when we're on teams, and one thing that you have to also be aware of is that there's a reason that, like, stand-ups often become more famous than sketch comedians or improv comedians. It's because their name is said more often, you know? So it's that whole thing with Chevy Chase being the first breakout star from Saturday Night Live because he got to say his name every week. So he wanted to put my name. Right, that's why I put the name in the title.
He was funny also.
Right. Yeah.
He was also a funny person on the show.
But the question is, like, was he light years more funny than Aykroyd or Belushi, you know? So it's like, you've got to get your name out there. That's important.
We've moved into an age where we are less. We are discouraging people from putting their names in the titles of shows.
Uh-huh.
But you circumvented that by having like the show kind of be about you.
Yeah.
And that you're addicted.
it has to be. Right.
So by making yourself a sort of meta character,
you
are able to circumvent the aesthetic principle behind not.
I'm writing a one-man show asking if Hines Ward, the Pittsburgh football player, will be famous. So my show is called Will Hines Ward Be Famous.
And it's get rid of the Ward, just Will Hines Be Famous.
You know what, that is better. I'll just say Will Hines Be Famous.
Yeah.
And it's about the Pittsburgh Steelers.
Sure. Perfect.
And it's a really deep show.
Yeah, so I made myself a character in the show.
Yeah.
Actually is the dictator.
Yes.
On this little island nation in the Middle East. And the genesis of the show was I had a bunch of like monologues, like one-person monologues written that I had been working on, and I was like, I had a bunch of different framing devices, and then I found after a night out, this is what happens. I write emails when I'm like drunk, but like, is what happens. So I find after a night out on my iPhone, in the note section of my iPhone, just one line, it says, a dictator does his shoe. I'm like, a dictator does his shoe? I can't possibly mean a dictator having sex with a shoe.
Right.
I'm like, oh, a dictator does his show.
Right,
it was just a typo.
Right.
And I'm like, that's a great idea. Thanks, drunk Mike.
Yes.
So so I started like kind of like working around like how could that work, like taking what I had and seeing if we could put it together. I grabbed Neil Casey, who directed it, did a great job, was a wonderful director, and I was like, I had a bunch of different ideas. And he was like, the dictator one sounds like the most promising one. And I'm glad we went with it because it was able to like create like a nice thread throughout it.
Sure.
It's a really funny show.
Yeah, it's hilarious.
So it's got a really funny postcard, which is you breastfeeding a baby.
Yes.
You as the dictator character.
Yeah.
Breastfeeding
which is
a child.
Creepy.
It's creepy,
the dictator's
right?
trying to put forward his image as like the nurturing father of the country,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, yeah, the father, mother of the country. Mm-hmm.
So once you come up with that idea, you decide that on a framing device,
mm-hmm.
how much, what's the process like of fitting all of these monologues that you have?
Let me interject and point out to the audience that John Frusciante is currently wearing a magenta robe. Mm-hmm. A full magenta monk's robe, and is holding a single candle.
Uh-huh.
Mike and I are sitting here in casual clothes, and John is in the corner, shrouded in a robe, and holding a candle. I think that adds a lot to your last question.
Can you mention my pipe?
I'm so sorry. I thought you were. People knew you were trying to quit smoking, so I didn't want to call you out on that. But you have an incense pipe.
Thank you.
It just burns incense?
Mm-hmm. It burns incense. No smoking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I get the sensation of holding something that I'm smoking.
Right.
Yeah.
But also, I put forth the idea that I'm a pompous ass.
That's nice. Right. So you had a question about frameworks?
Yes. What's the process of then inserting all of those monologues into? Do you find there's things you have to lose, things you have to significantly change?
Well, one of the things that we really learned with the Week of Kindness was, because we love doing like weird frames for our shows in the Week of Kindness. We had a show called Dances with Wolf Shirts, like well before Wolf Shirts became a thing, man. The first one was 2006. Precious. Right.
What was your last show? The last show had a really great frame.
Oh, the last show Week of Kindness did was in Sketchfest 2009.
Yes.
And it was the B Movie Awards.
Yes.
But it was the BEE Movie Awards, the movie,
yeah, the B movie,
Jerry Seinfeld's film, and it was just these two guys giving award that were the producers of B Movie giving awards to everyone that was involved in B Movie.
Yeah,
it was really fun. We did that show.
Yeah, I think that show was at Sketchfest, and I remember it was really funny, and I wanted you guys to run it.
I know we should have, and
but
we
no,
just
it's
never
fine.
Did.
It's fine. Don't worry about it. It's fine. I get over it.
No, we should have run it. We should
have
run it.
I have a show called Will Hines. The B Movie Awards.
Will Hines presents the B Movie Awards.
It's asking if Hines Award will present.
So one of the things I enjoy about frames is you write your material without regard to a frame. You write like 60-70% of your material.
Uh-huh.
You have a tenuous frame over the whole thing. And then afterwards, because you want to make sure that your sketches are strong first, that you have a strong core.
Right.
Then you figure out like all you need is a couple sentences of justification to make any sketch make sense in any show.
Right.
I feel very strongly about that.
Yes.
Whereas, like, if you try to write only for one idea,
you
limit yourself.
Yeah, right.
You know.
Hmm.
So with Dictator, it was like, all right, I got this idea for this yo-yo thing. We came up with this. Me and Neil came up with this idea like a long time ago. We wanted to do like a Secrets of Yo-Yo Unmasked, like Behind the Magic sort of thing, but with yo-yos.
Uh-huh.
And we wanted to make it a full show. We wanted to make it just me learning how to do yo-yos and actually just submitting the show. And it was just not supposed to be funny at all. It was like super serious. Like
how many pitches do you hear like that? How many pitches do you either, not you, but in this world that we live in, how many pitches do we either come up with or hear where someone's like, here's the whole show. The whole guy is waiting for somebody to answer the phone for 30 minutes, and that's all that happens. That's it.
Yeah.
How awesome would that be?
Yeah.
If someone had the balls to do that.
Someone just finally had the courage to bore the shit out of the audience for 30 minutes. That's not exactly what your idea was.
That would be.
You would have been like, people would have gone in for comedy and be like, what the fuck is this?
That would be a great off Broadway self-indulgent project.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
To do.
Yeah. So we that was like one of the ideas that was in there, and then it's like a matter of like how do we fit this into the show, and you know how the idea. Well, why not make this yo-yo guy the dictator's son? So it's like that's all you need to do to like kind of like justify it.
Okay. Right.
Yeah.
So it's writing what you think is funny, and then finding where it fits into
absolutely
what you want to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And then what we found is that as we were working on it, that things that were the things that ended up getting kind of pushed out of the show were the ones that were kind of like had the least amount to do with it. Because I did write new stuff just for the dictator.
Mm-hmm.
And those ended up being the things that stayed in more than like, I had a character named Willie Crystal that was in the Spank that took out, which is an older Week of Kindness character.
It is, right?
Yes.
Because I remember watching that and thinking like, where have I seen this before? And I couldn't remember.
Crystal. It's this morbidly obese guy who has a show called 700 Sundays, an off-Broadway show.
Uh-huh.
A one-man show. It was on Broadway, actually, in the
but
story.
But it's 700 D-A-E-S, right?
Yes,
700 Ice Cream Sundays.
700
right?
Ice Cream Sundays. So he's just this really, he's an asshole who just talks about all the important moments of his life, but then he just focuses on the ice cream that was involved in them. And it just, you hear like through the periphery that he's just a very bad person. Like,
right.
Yeah, he refers to the his son being born as the worst day of his life because the hospital had terrible Sundays. But so like that ended up coming out because it was like we had the things that were more germane to the dictator story than right. a guy in a wheelchair that can't stand up, has like horribly ratty hair.
Hilarious.
Yeah.
Well, that show is great. Dictator for Life is great, and you should all go see it.
Everyone should see it.
At the very least, you should go onto Facebook and look at the postcard image for it, because it's disturbingly hilarious.
It's terrible.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell us about being on Ruru.
Oh, my God. Being on Death by Ruru is awesome. It's so fun. Being on Death by Ruru is just, like, the best thing in the world. I joined in March of 2010.
So. Who else was on at that time?
So, Ruru in March of 2010. So... Curtis had left the summer before.
Right.
He left towards the end of the summer, and I believe...
Winter, I think. I think he stuck around till December.
Was he around till December?
Yeah, I think that's right.
He was, like, around till December. So Curtis left, and then Pally left, because Pally was blowing up, right?
He yes.
just right. moved.
So
Pally just bought Universal Studios this morning.
Oh, yeah. He's huge. Yeah. He's huge. He owns a studio now. Yeah.
The theme park or the studio?
The theme islands park. Of Adventure.
Just the theme park, yeah.
And only islands. And
yes, not the islands whole thing. Do you think it's crazy? I'm not exaggerating.
Yeah, come on.
He just bought Islands of Adventure. In the
on the, yeah, the, like the Thor.
Yeah.
The Thor roller coaster.
Yeah.
So, like, yeah, so at the time it was Neil, Gemberling, Anthony Tamanik, Gil, and Gavin, right?
Right.
So they added me and John Murray.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I think that's interesting because that team had such a pronounced voice throughout its whole time. Mm-hmm. You know, and all of us here at the theater know Ruru so well.
Yeah.
That I think that must be part of making the transition, if not difficult, then at least like something to process. Like, how do you fit into this voice or how does it change? And Curtis was such a big part of it.
Oh, yeah.
That the departure of Curtis, like, changes that team's energy a lot.
Oh, sure. It's just like, how do you live up to that? You know, you're like on Ruru, which everyone like dreams of. I mean, I don't want to exaggerate that, but I do think that there's like a lot. It's like, oh shit, I would be on Ruru, you know? Uh-huh. And then so you get that call and you're like, fuck, this is awesome. Then you're like, oh, now the expectations, how are we going to live up to this? And there definitely, I think there was probably a good month or two of like transition where at least I felt like, oh shit, what is this? Am I doing it all right? Am I doing it right? And then mm-hmm. and then you just start realizing it's the whole gorilla thing, going back to the gorilla thing. Like, you just have to be confident. That's what they wanted you on the team for. Just like if you get on Herald Night or you're asked to join an indie team, it's all the same thing. People have seen you perform, and they want you for whatever reasons that they want you. So you don't need to change what you're doing. It's not like there was any expectations like, well, now Mike's here. Mike, we want you to do something different than what you've ever done.
You know? We're asking you to fill this specific role or void. It's not that at all.
Not at all.
We want your energy and your presence on this team.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so once that was like a really liberating feeling. Just every Saturday it's the best. It's just so much fun.
What's the difference in your experience performing for the weekend rather than performing for Herald Night?
All right. Well, so I would say the main difference between performing for the two is that Herald Night, you're trying to do something. You're trying to do a good Herald.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very specific goal that you have.
Yes.
And I find that to be difficult. I always found that to be somewhat difficult because I feel like the nature of improv is sometimes it might not be going towards a Herald. Things might not be going towards a Herald. The mood of the world might not be that like these eight people are there to do a Herald. They might need to do something that's different. They might, mm-hmm. you know, just like sometimes in our fucked up family, we have like five just long scenes, mm-hmm. or we have 15 to 20 short scenes. You know, like you don't know where everyone's biology is at in any given moment.
Sure.
So I found that was the biggest difference is knowing that you're not like shooting for anything specific,
mm-hmm.
you know, other than just like hopefully doing good scene work. And that was the biggest change between it. And you don't have to worry about notes after.
Right.
There's not the anxiety of like, well, if I don't do well at this show, what happens in the future?
Right.
You know, you start getting rid of that all, and it just becomes more about just improv, like just pure, like we're doing improv together,
yeah,
and that's what we want to do, and it's fun.
Uh-huh.
There's no stakes attached to it, you know?
Yes. Yeah, which is a really powerful and important place to get to.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
You know, it's very actualizing. You feel like more actualized as an improviser.
So do you think it's easier?
Is it easier than Herald Night? One thing, I think that like when you start getting that taste, you get a little taste of performing for an hour. Mm-hmm. That's where you're like, all right, it feels easier because 25 minutes with eight people, it's not a lot of time. You know, it's not a lot of time. It's a very compact.
Yeah.
And when I started doing Torco, I started getting that feel of like, ooh, I have an hour. I can stretch my legs. You know, every single move isn't as important because now we have a full hour. So you don't think about each move as like chess game like with it, right? The same thing doing Baby Wants Candy because those shows are an hour long. So you start like realizing like when you have like an hour to perform, it takes, again, takes the pressure off of each individual moment.
Right. Yeah, and it's also performing every week must be really like.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you've become a better improviser just from the repetition and the regularity of it?
Yeah, because you just you know that every Saturday, no matter what, you're going to get out there and you're going to perform.
Do you guys still do a mono scene in the second half?
We do a mono scene in the second half.
So how's your understanding of doing that change, or has it, or I don't know? Do you have any advice over doing a good mono scene?
Every mono scene has to have a lot of mini scenes in it. Mm-hmm. Some mono scenes will work with like three people sitting around in a circle talking. That can be compelling. But most likely you're going to want to change up the dynamic about as often as you would change up scenes in a normal like montage or Herald.
Right.
So you want to make sure that there's that you're moving, that the water doesn't become stagnant, that characters enter, characters leave, that it's not just like, all right, we've been doing the same thing for half an hour. And sometimes that's challenging because sometimes it's fun to sit around and just
shoot
the
shit. Sure, I saw Ruben Williams do a great mono scene where just four of them around a table in a railroad car.
Yeah.
At a restaurant.
We had
one of the guys owned a railroad. That's irrelevant. Okay. Sorry.
We had
a great sitting hair.
Yeah. We had a super fun one earlier this year. It was me, Gambrilling, and Antaminic. It was just the three of us. And we were going on a road. We were driving. I was the kid in the back. And Gambrilling was the mom. And Antaminic was the dad. And they were driving me to college.
Uh-huh.
And that was the whole thing. It was just all in a car the entire time. We never left the car the entire time. So sometimes that can be great. But even in that, you have to vary up what you're talking about. Now we're Change focusing the on the son masturbating in the back or whatever, right? Now we're focusing on the dynamic between the husband and the wife. Now we're focusing on like worrying about college. You know, you have to just keep changing up that dynamic.
The same way an actual conversation between people might happen.
Yeah,
I don't see your point.
Yeah. Well,
I don't see your
when
point.
People have conversations, Will.
Yes.
When you are able to have, I mean, you as a person, if you ever get to the point where you're able to have a conversation.
Oh, that's why I don't understand. I don't do that.
Yeah. You don't have conversations?
No. I'm on my own at all times.
If you can ever actually, have established a human relationship, what they do is, the dynamics change.
Oh, okay. I've read about this. Like in books.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. You should get away from the books and get out. Right. Like, go to a park and talk to a stranger is what you should do. Like,
I can't. There's too many restraining orders against me.
Oh.
But I see what you're saying, and I'll apply that to real life. how about this? Rue Romano scenes, Mike Still.
Yes.
I think they end huge so well so often. I think that's a challenge, and I watch students learning to do mono scenes, or even when I'm doing, the ending of a long-form piece is so difficult. The only way that a Herald is maybe easier than other long forms is there's kind of a built-in structure to have your ending have connections. Like it's really in the...
Sure.
Structure as we teach it here to have that happen.
Even
if they're shallow and they're weird, like Connection Island things, there's some kind of feeling of an ending.
I love, but that's my favorite part. I don't know. How do you pick the favorite part of the Herald? It's like picking
you got a robe on.
What's that?
You just put a robe on.
I put a robe on.
Oh, you found my extra robe.
Oh, yeah. It was just hanging up over here. Can I light this incense pipe?
Please do.
Oh, this is good sage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm,
it smells nice. I would say that, you know what, it goes back to like framing in general with comedy, right? Is that I really truly think if you look at movies, comedic movies, you look at sketch shows, you look at improv.
Yes.
If it all becomes only about the frame, then there's no meat to it. You have to have the substantive funny moments, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's why like the best comedy movies have... You know, they have their overarching story, but it's not just all in service of the story. You know, like everything is not only like, this is another plot thing, right? You have bits. You
like
have
a bits young Frankenstein has the putting on the Ritz scene.
Exactly. You know, I bet that was, I don't know anything about the history of young Frankenstein, but like, I wouldn't be surprised if that was just an idea they had separate from everything else. And they're like, how do we work this in? Frankenstein singing, putting on the Ritz, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
How do we work it in? So going back to mono scene, I think it's important that if you are sitting there on stage worrying about how the plot's going to come together at every moment, you're screwed, right?
Yeah.
But if you're doing different scenes, your mini scenes within your mono scene.
Okay.
And then in the last 5 minutes, you say, you know what? We have all these elements on the table. Let's make them come together.
Mm-hmm. So that's when you worry about it.
You don't worry about it till the end.
But you do, maybe 5 minutes out, you do.
Yeah.
You're like, we're in the last leg now. So what now do we it's have time on the table? To bring right. something that's on the, no more new things.
Yeah.
Let's reuse something we already have.
Well, let's, right? Yeah, that you have a point where we're not introducing anything new, unless you have like a nice weird... god come in, and you know,
yeah.
Deo Ex Machina come in and, sure. and be like, fix everything. That yeah. happens sometimes.
Sure.
There's a lot of times like a monster will show up or some sort of like supernatural thing will occur, right?
But you're thinking only of the moment and of just what is good in this moment until you get to the ending segment, which is we're going to say like yeah. five right. or 7 minutes maybe out.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's just one of the, you know, I think improv is...
How did the car one end?
How did the car one end? Did we get into an accident? I don't remember if we got into an accident or not. I don't remember how the car one ended.
Okay.
You can't...
I don't remember.
You can't plant a salad bowl. Right?
It's well, the whole thing. Gotta, if you see a salad bowl gotta, in the first act,
right.
the salad bowl, the salad has to be made in the second act and has to be eaten in the third act.
You can't harvest a salad bowl. Okay. Right?
No, wait, gotta, we're talking different analogies.
I recognize plant, that's a sentence.
You've got to plant seeds.
Okay.
Right?
For you
a bowl? Yeah, for what will eventually so someone become is like, a
so,
salad.
So you're saying in the situation that someone's like, don't worry, well, I got a salad bowl we're going to eat. And you have to be like, no, you have to plant the seeds.
Yeah,
first.
You have to plant
so
the seeds.
So if you're
first.
Talking to a complete idiot that doesn't understand it, salads don't just appear in bowls?
Yes. Right. Well, you have to plant the seeds. You have to harvest them. You have to let them grow. You have to water them.
Your model okay. scenes are like 6 months long.
Yeah, really. Yeah, they're full season. And if, God forbid, we have some kind of fallow ground, right. we cannot...
Well, that's why we yeah. need, in your model scenes, to have the four-field system. Where
yeah.
you rotate the crops that are in your field, so things that use a lot of nitrogen are rotated against the season with things that make a lot of nitrogen.
That's yeah. right.
I don't know if this happens on Jethro Ruru, Tull. But a lot of times... I don't know if this happens to you guys, but a lot of times the government will come to me and buy my mono scenes.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Huge
so
subsidies.
So just growing them really
Ruru
for nobody.
Has massive mono scene subsidies for us just to like produce tons of corn.
Okay. Anything else?
No, I've got my agenda items are filled.
Mine are too. Mike Still, Dictator for Life.
Come and see it.
Come and see the show. I don't know when this...
I might get it up today. I might post this today.
That would be great.
I might go do this right now.
If it is today, go see it tomorrow. I would say when
but
you're listening
to
this...
But if it is September when you're listening to this, I apologize.
Check the schedule.
Yeah, check the website. Check the schedule anyway and see when the show is up.
Yeah, and Mike, thanks for strong-arming us into bringing this thing back.
There's two pieces of sandwich left, so... If this gets up like real soon,
we're gonna be in the teacher's foil.
Yeah, just they'll be in the front of the office.
Okay, great.
You're at the training center. Come get the sandwich. There's an asparagus one and a short rib one.
Yeah, and they're great.
They're really good sandwiches. They might be soggy by then.
Yeah. So hopefully, maybe this will like jumpstart us into.
Yeah, it could happen.
Maybe.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Will.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. Maybe we'll have another one soon.
I hope so.
Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.